You live for planning the perfect trip. The thrill of comparing hotels, scoring that impossible reservation, and piecing together an unforgettable itinerary. You already think like a travel advisor, so why not just be one? Fora is a modern travel agency built for people who love to plan vacations and help others travel well. As a Fora advisor, you'll be set up for success with best-in-class training, powerful booking tools, and a vibrant global community of experts sharing real insider tips. Fora helps you turn your love of planning vacations into a business with a flexible, meaningful stream of income, with commission on every hotel, cruise, and activity you book. And with access to more than 7,000 preferred partners, you'll unlock VIP perks like upgrades, resort credits, and late checkout, giving you and your clients the kind of elevated travel experiences regular travelers simply don't get. Getting started is as easy as booking trips for people you already know. Become a Fora advisor today at foratravel.com/earn. That's foratravel.com/earn.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're plunging into the life of a name that, well, for generations has just screamed Hollywood glamour. A femme fatale, a siren of the silver screen during an era absolutely packed with iconic stars, Ava Gardner. Mm-hmm. You picture that stunning beauty, right? That undeniable screen presence. But what if we told you that behind the public persona, behind those, you know, mesmerizing eyes, there was this fiercely independent woman? Her life was this captivating blend of incredibly humble beginnings, surprising resilience, and just an unwavering commitment to her own deeply held values.
That's exactly right. Today, we're taking a truly immersive deep dive into a collection of sources that, well, they really peel back the layers of Ava Lavinia Gardner's remarkable life. We're going far beyond the legend to reveal the real woman. We're tracing her journey from her rural North Carolina roots all the way to global fame and, importantly, her profound later years. Our mission for you, our listener, is to extract the most compelling insights, those truly unexpected facts, and really get to the true spirit of a woman who, without a doubt, lived life unapologetically on her own terms, often against the powerful current of Hollywood, actually.
And here's where it gets really interesting right from the start. A little nugget to grab your attention, because it tells you almost everything about Ava Gardner's raw appeal.
Right.
Imagine being told by a major studio head, Louis B. Mayer himself, and he was known for being a very, very shrewd judge of talent.
Oh, absolutely. One of the sharpest.
He says she can't sing, she can't act, she can't talk, she's terrific.
That quote, it's legendary.
That, my friends, was Ava Gardner's astonishing entry into Hollywood. It truly makes you wonder, doesn't it? What does that raw, undeniable star quality actually entail, especially when, you know, the conventional talents were deemed lacking right there at the start. Mm. We're going to explore precisely why that seemingly contradictory assessment, coming from one of the most powerful men in the industry, actually set her on a path to becoming one of the American Film Institute's greatest female screen legends. It's a testament not just to beauty, but to an almost, I don't know, primal charisma.
Yeah, something magnetic.
So, to truly understand that terrific quality Mara saw, mm-hmm. we have to go back, way back to where it all began, far, far from the glamour of Hollywood. Let's unpack this a bit.
Okay.
Ava Lavinia Gardner was born on December 24th, 1922, in a place called Grabtown, North Carolina. Now, when you picture the birthplace of a Hollywood icon, Grabtown probably isn't the first image that springs to mind, is it?
Not exactly, no. It sounds almost fictional. But it's real.
It's real. Far from the glittering boulevards and opulent mansions we associate with movie stars. But it's where her story begins, and it's a foundation that, you know, profoundly shaped her.
And interesting because, contrary to what some might assume about a rural Southern upbringing back then, her family wasn't initially struggling, not at all. In fact, by community standards, they were actually better than well-to-do.
Really?
Yeah. Her father, Jonas, was a real man of enterprise, you know, in a way that set them apart in rural North Carolina. They had a substantial tobacco and cotton farm, which was a big deal back then, owning land.
Mm-hmm.
But he also very shrewdly diversified their income.
How so?
Well, he operated a local sawmill, turning timber into lumber, which was vital for the community. And he ran a bustling country store, you know, the kind that was more than just a shop. It was like a social hub, selling everything from groceries and feed to farm supplies.
Right, the center of town almost.
Exactly. So this multifaceted operation meant her childhood, at least the earliest years, was far from that typical narrative of rural hardship. It offered young Ava a stability and a sense of community that would, well, profoundly contrast with the struggles that were, unfortunately, just around the corner.
The Great Depression.
The Great Depression. Its shadow was long and wide, and it didn't spare even comparatively well-off families like the Gardners. It drastically changed their fortunes. Like so many across America, they lost their property.
Everything. The farm, the store.
Yep. The farm, the store, all gone. This forced them to adapt in profound, often heartbreaking ways. Her mother, Molly, who sounds like a woman of immense resilience herself, she took on work as a cook and housekeeper at a dormitory for teachers at the nearby Brogdon School. Part of her pay for those long hours was board for the family, which was absolutely crucial for their survival.
Wow. And her father?
Jonas. Jonas, despite having been the successful landowner and businessman, now had to share crop tobacco, basically renting land and giving a chunk of his crop to the landlord. And he took on whatever odd jobs he could find at sawmills just to supplement their dwindling income. They were really, truly hustling to survive. A stark lesson in the fragility of fortune, you know?
Absolutely. And the upheaval didn't stop there, did it?
No, it didn't. The family's sort of nomadic struggle continued as they chased opportunities. In 1931, the teacher school closed, prompting another big move. They relocated to Newport News, Virginia, a bustling port city. Completely different vibe. Her mother managed a boarding house there, this time catering to ship workers, you know, with the wartime economy booming. This gave Ava glimpses of a wider world outside of rural Grabtown.
And then came a really significant loss.
A profoundly impactful event for young Ava. In 1938, when she was just 15 years old, her father became gravely ill and tragically died from bronchitis. Losing her father at such a tender, formative age, well, it was a defining moment. It left an indelible mark on her, as we'll definitely hear later when we discuss her views on faith.
15 is so young.
Terribly young. Following his death, the family moved yet again, returning to North Carolina, this time to Rock Ridge near Wilson. Her mother continued running another boarding house for teachers there. Ava attended high school in Rock Ridge, graduating in 1939.
And this period was still marked by financial struggles.
Oh, very much so. To the point where she vividly recalled having to wear hand-me-down clothes. And not just any hand-me-downs, but ones that apparently led to heartbreaking ridicule from her classmates.
Oh, that's awful. The future fashion icon being ridiculed for clothes.
Exactly. Can you imagine the future screen siren, known for her unparalleled style, feeling that sting of embarrassment? It's such a stark contrast to the glamour she would later embody. And you have to think it fueled a deep-seated desire for self-sufficiency.
No doubt.
After high school, she even attended secretarial classes at Atlantic Christian College for about a year. It really looked like she was headed down a very different, very practical life path, maybe an office job somewhere local, definitely not a global stage.
Which makes her discovery even more remarkable.
Oh, absolutely. And what's particularly striking when you consider those humble beginnings we just talked about is how incredibly close Ava Gardner came to a completely different life. Her entry into Hollywood was nothing short of a stroke of serendipity, a truly classic small town to superstardom story. It wasn't planned. It was almost stumbled upon. Pure chance, really.
So how did it happen? The portrait, right?
The portrait. It all started in the summer of 1940. Ava, then an 18-year-old student, was visiting her older sister, Bappy, in New York City. Bappy's husband, Larry Tarr, happened to be a professional photographer with a studio right on Fifth Avenue.
Prime location.
Exactly. He offered to take Ava's portrait, not just a snapshot, mind you, but a high-quality professional gift for her mother back home. The moment he saw the developed photographs, he was apparently just stunned. The raw beauty, the natural magnetism, that almost untamed quality in her features, it was undeniable.
He saw something special.
He really did. He was so pleased with the results that he decided to display the finished photograph prominently in the front window of his studio on Fifth Avenue, one of the most high-traffic, visible, prestigious locations in the city. Imagine the number of influential people walking by that window every single day.
And one of them noticed.
And that's precisely where Barnard Duhon enters the picture. He was a legal clerk at Loews Theaters, which owned MGM. But here's a fun little detail that adds to the Hollywood lore. Duhon often posed as an MGM talent scout.
Ah, a bit of self-promotion there.
You could say that. Using the MGM connection to, let's say, network cleverly and maybe impress aspiring stars, Duhon spotted Gardner's portrait in the window, immediately recognizing something truly special, that certain je ne sais quoi that just screamed, movie star.
So he went in.
He went into the studio, tried to get her number from the receptionist, but she, maybe sensing his unofficial status or just following rules, turned him down. But Duhon, clearly persistent and with a good eye, commented, somebody should send her info to MGM.
The brother-in-law heard that.
Larry Tarr, the photographer brother-in-law, recognized the potential. He didn't hesitate. He acted on that suggestion immediately, sending Ava's portrait and contact info straight to the studio.
Wow. Just like that.
Just like that. Shortly after, Ava, still enrolled back at Atlantic Christian College, gets an invitation. She travels back to MGM's New York office for an interview with Al Altman, the head of New York talent.
And the screen test. I heard it was pretty basic.
Remarkably low-key, almost understated, designed to capture her natural movement, her presence. Cameras rolling, Altman just directed the completely unseasoned 18-year-old to walk towards the camera, turn, walk away, and then very naturally rearrange some flowers in a vase.
That's it?
That was pretty much it. He was looking for poise, grace, that inherent magnetism you can't really teach. But crucially, Al Altman did not try to record her voice because, as he later said, her strong Southern accent was nearly incomprehensible to him. Understanding her was a real challenge. This detail just underscores the magnitude of her transformation once she got to Hollywood. She had to be entirely remade, starting with that voice.
But the look was enough.
The look was more than enough. Despite the speech issue, the raw visual appeal was undeniable. Louis B. Mayer, the formidable, famously shrewd head of MGM, recognized it instantly when he saw the test footage. He sent back that now famous, seemingly contradictory telegram.
She can't sing, she can't act, she can't talk, she's terrific.
That's the one. It captures the essence of her raw, undeniable screen presence. The sheer force of her beauty and magnetism that just transcended traditional acting skills at that moment. It was star quality, pure and simple.
So she got the contract.
She was offered a standard 7-year contract by the studio, basically buying her talent and her future. And so in 1941, Ava Gardner, accompanied by her sister Bappy, left college and her familiar North Carolina life behind and headed for Hollywood.
And MGM's first job, fix the problems.
Exactly. First order of business, address those initial perceived shortcomings. They immediately gave her a speech coach to tackle that pronounced Carolina drawl and Harriet Lee as her singing teacher. The sculpting process began.
So she was terrific, as Mayer put it, that raw talent was there, but it certainly wasn't an overnight sensation, was it? That's kind of a Hollywood myth.
Oh, completely. The reality for Ava Gardner, even with Mayer's stamp of approval, was more of a, well, a bit of a grind, a slow, methodical climb within that studio system.
Your first film appearance was tiny.
Tiny. A walk-on role, literally just walking across the screen in a Norma Shearer movie called We Were Dancing in 1942. Sounds glamorous, but she was just a face in the crowd, uncredited.
And that wasn't a one-off.
Not at all. That was followed by 15 more bit parts, many uncredited, mostly at MGM. She played everything from girl in car to nightclub patron. It really shows you the arduous grind of the studio system.
Right. They owned you, basically.
Absolutely. Contract players were essentially property. The studio dictated your roles, your image, your schedule, even your love life sometimes. It was an industrial machine. She had to learn, adapt, and just be patient, waiting for her moment.
Until 1943.
Yes, 1943. 2 long years after arriving, she finally got her first screen billing in a film called Ghosts on the Loose. A small but significant milestone, her name was actually on the theatrical poster. Finally, some real recognition after years of anonymity. It's a reminder that even the biggest stars often start in roles that barely register, just building their craft and biding their time.
And this gradual grinding ascent brings us to a pivotal point.
It really does. If we connect this to the bigger picture, her breakthrough role truly defined her early persona and marked a dramatic shift in her career trajectory, finally making her a star after those frustrating early years.
The Killers.
The Killers, 1946. After 5 years of walk-ons and bit parts, honing her craft, perfecting that screen presence, Ava Gardner burst into prominence. It was a Mark Hellinger production.
And she played.
Kitty Collins. The absolute quintessential femme fatale, alluring, mysterious, dangerous, using her charm to ensnare men. Classic film noir stuff. This was the role that critics and audiences finally noticed. It propelled her from studio ingenue to leading lady almost overnight. Her performance was just mesmerizing, showcasing that magnetic presence that had been simmering.
But success didn't necessarily mean confidence, did it? I read something about the commissary.
Yes, that's incredibly poignant. Despite the good reviews and her burgeoning fame, she apparently maintained this surprisingly fragile self-image. Actress Arlene Dahl, who knew her, shared this incredibly revealing detail. Ava wouldn't even go eat in the commissary because she was so scared to walk in and see Lana Turner and Greer Garson.
Wow. Lana Turner and Greer Garson, huge stars.
Huge stars. And Ava, even as her own star was rising, felt intimidated. This anecdote exposes a deep, almost startling vulnerability beneath that confident, glamorous image she was already projecting.
It makes you wonder how she reconciled that inner insecurity with the public persona, that fierce independence from Grabtown meeting Hollywood pressure.
Exactly. Was it sheer will? Self-preservation? Did she just compartmentalize? This tension between the inner self and the outer image is a recurring, often poignant theme in her life. It really highlights the immense psychological toll of stardom, even for those who seem to conquer it so effortlessly.
But the 1950s were undeniably her decade,
right?
Cementing her status.
Undeniably. The 50s cemented her as a top star and, arguably, Hollywood's most beautiful woman. This decade saw her truly flourish as a leading lady in a string of iconic films, showcasing her versatility and growing dramatic chops.
Like Showboat.
Yep. Beloved musicals like Showboat and the visually stunning Candora and The Flying Dutchman, both from 51, she truly shone in those. Then came The Snows of Kilimanjaro in 52, a major success. And the film that earned her that crucial Academy Award nomination for Best Actress.
Mogambo.
Mogambo, 1953. Holding her own against screen legends Clark Gable and Grace Kelly. That nomination was huge validation for her acting talent, beyond just the beauty.
And the barefoot Contessa seemed almost tailor-made for her.
It really did, in 1954. Playing the doomed beauty Maria Vargas, a fiercely independent Spanish dancer turned international movie star. Her raw passion clashing with Hollywood's artificiality. And what's intriguing is that her real-life habit of often going barefoot actually influenced her accepting the part.
Ah, that's great. A little bit of Ava and Maria.
Exactly. Bringing authenticity. She also got a BAFTA nomination for Best Foreign Actress for her powerful work in Bhowani Junction in 56, playing an Anglo-Indian woman navigating complex racial tensions.
She wasn't shying away from tough roles.
Not at all. And she continued her streak with acclaimed films like The Sun, also rises in 57, based on Hemingway, and the post-apocalyptic drama On the Beach in 59, earning another BAFTA nomination for that one, too.
And her roles became more sophisticated over time.
Definitely. Throughout this prolific period, she moved beyond just the alluring temptress. She was often playing duchesses, baronesses, other women of noble lineage. It showed her evolving screen presence, that elegance and gravitas she brought.
And off camera, she was known for being pretty witty, right?
Oh, famously so. Sharp wit, pithy remarks. Like her famous assessment of director John Ford, who directed Mogambo.
What did she say?
The meanest man on earth. Thoroughly evil. Adored him.
Classic Ava. That tells you so much about her personality.
Right. Her complexity, her ability to see the humanity, even the charm in difficult people.
She certainly didn't slow down after the 50s. Far from it. Ava Gardner kept challenging herself, pushing beyond that femme fatale typecast that launched her.
Mm-hmm, definitely diversifying.
The 1960s brought us those epic historical dramas like 55 Days at Peking in 63 with Charlton Heston and David Niven about the Boxer Rebellion, and then 7 Days in May in 64, that tense political thriller about a military takeover.
Great cast in that one. Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas.
Right. Big, significant picture showing her increasing dramatic range and her ability to hold her own against these really formidable leading men.
And then there was The Bible.
Yes. One role that truly stands out, revealing a different facet of her artistic ambition, is her portrayal of Sarah, Abraham's wife, in John Huston's huge epic, The Bible, in the beginning, from 1966.
Seems like a departure for her.
On the surface, maybe. Demanding biblical gravitas, vulnerability. But she shared this really compelling quote about why she took it, and it reveals so much about her depth as an actress, her desire to evolve. She said about Huston, "He had more faith in me than I did myself."
That's quite an admission.
Isn't it? She continued, "Now I'm glad I listened, for it is a challenging role and a very demanding one. I start out as a young wife and age through various periods, forcing me to adjust psychologically to each age. It is a complete departure for me, and most intriguing. In this role, I must create a character, not just play one."
Wow, that's not just an actress talking, that's an artist focused on the craft.
Exactly. Wanting to truly inhabit a character, explore its journey. It speaks volumes about her dedication to finding roles that genuinely stretched her abilities.
Speaking of critical high points, The Night of the Iguana in 1964, that was arguably her last truly major leading role and a significant critical success, really showcased her mature dramatic power.
Based on a Tennessee Williams play, right? directed by Houston again.
That's right. Intense drama, filmed on location in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Stunning landscapes. She starred opposite the formidable Richard Burton, playing this atheist clergyman, and the elegant Deborah Kerr as a gentle artist.
I heard the production itself is pretty dramatic off-screen, too.
Oh, notoriously so, often mirroring the intense passions on screen. Interestingly, Houston insisted on filming in black and white, a decision he later regretted because he felt the vivid colors of the Mexican flora and coast were stunning and he'd missed a visual opportunity.
Huh. But her performance was acclaimed.
Widely acclaimed. Her portrayal of Maxine Falk, the earthy, resilient owner of the rundown hotel, it was nuanced, strong. She got nominations for a Golden Globe for Best Actress, a BAFTA for Best Actress, placing her among the top dramatic actresses that year.
Did she win anything for it?
She did. She won the Silver Shell for Best Actress at the prestigious San Sebastian International Film Festival that year. A significant international award underscoring the power and nuance she brought to that complex role. A real testament to her artistry beyond the iconic beauty.
And here's another moment that just perfectly highlights her strong personality and incredible self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Even as she got older and Hollywood started, you know, valuing youth above all,
mm-hmm.
in 1966, she briefly sought the role of Mrs. Robinson in Mike Nichols' classic, The Graduate.
Ava Gardner as Mrs. Robinson. Wow, that's hard to picture, but intriguing.
Right. She reportedly called Nichols directly with her typical forthrightness. I want to see you. I want to talk about this graduate thing. But then came the kicker, pure vintage Ava, encapsulating her fierce spirit. First of all, I strip for nobody.
Love it. Setting boundaries.
Absolutely. She understood the role, but she knew her own lines. Now, Nichols never seriously considered her, mostly due to age. She was 44, and Bancroft, who got the part, was 35, and the character needed to be younger.
Right, the age dynamic was key.
But the fact that Nichols still visited her at her hotel, even knowing he wouldn't cast her, speaks volumes about her enduring presence, her formidable personality, the sheer power she commanded, even in a changing Hollywood. She could still demand and get attention from the top directors.
That says a lot. And she kept working, didn't she?
She did. Despite shifts in the industry, she continued acting regularly for two more decades, showing unwavering dedication, even as she transitioned into supporting roles more often. Appearances in big disaster films like Earthquake in 74.
Ah, yes, the disaster movie era.
And international thrillers like The Cassandra Crossing in 76. Her final appearance was in a TV film, Maggie, in 1986. She demonstrated her commitment to acting until almost the very end, proving it was a profession, a passion, not just a phase.
Which naturally leads us to ask, beyond the box office, the fan adoration, how was her immense impact formally recognized? Her talent and presence certainly garnered significant accolades, solidifying her place in history.
We mentioned the Oscar nomination.
Right, the Academy Award nomination for Best Actress for Mogambo. One of the highest honors in Hollywood, not just for beauty, but for dramatic ability.
And the Night of the Iguana brought more awards.
It did. Nominations for the Golden Globe and BAFTA, both highly respected. But also, as you heard, she won the prestigious Silver Shell for Best Actress at San Sebastian. These awards really speak to the depth and power she brought, proving she was far more than just strikingly beautiful. She was a truly talented actress.
And her overall legacy.
Well, that was further solidified in 1999 when the American Film Institute, in its definitive ranking, placed Ava Gardner at number 25 on its greatest female screen legends list.
Number 25, that's huge.
It's a profound acknowledgement, placing her among the most iconic and influential actresses ever alongside Katharine Hepburn, Bette Davis, Elizabeth Taylor. It confirms her star power, her artistic contributions, her indelible image resonated far beyond her active years, continuing to inspire. She truly earned her place in that pantheon.
Her professional life was certainly dramatic, full of twists, turns, triumphs, challenges, but her personal life, that was truly the stuff of headlines, rivaling any movie plot for intensity and complexity.
Oh, absolutely. The marriages especially.
She had that trio of high-profile marriages that absolutely captivated the public, often overshadowing her films in the tabloids. What was it about Ava with that fierce independence that seemed to draw her into these incredibly intense, often tumultuous relationships, particularly with men already so famous?
That's a great question. Maybe it was matching fire with fire.
Could be. Her first marriage was to fellow MGM contract player Mickey Rooney. They met soon after she arrived in L.A., this wide-eyed newcomer, married January 10th, 1942, in a whirlwind.
And secretly, right, because of the studio.
Exactly. Here's insight into that studio control.
Yeah.
The ceremony was in the remote town of Ballard, California, far from the press. Why? Because Louis B. Mayer was genuinely worried fans would desert Rooney's wholesome Andy Hardy movie series if his clean-cut star was known to be married.
Incredible. Dictating marriage for box office.
Totally. Ava divorced Rooney in 43, citing mental cruelty. Privately, though, she blamed his gambling, his notorious womanizing, his general immaturity. But remarkably, despite the pain, she didn't publicly trash his clean-cut Andy Hardy image. Shows surprising discretion, loyalty even then. She protected his persona.
Interesting. Then came Artie Shaw.
Her second marriage, equally brief, famously volatile, to the acclaimed jazz musician and bandleader Artie Shaw, 1945 to 46. Shaw was known for being, well, intellectual and demanding. And he had history himself, previously married to Lana Turner.
Another screen siren. Complicated dynamics there.
Definitely. Their relationship was apparently a clash of personalities. Ava, still developing intellectually, found herself often frustrated by Shaw's attempts to mold her into his ideal educated companion, led to frequent fiery arguments, a turbulent year, intense passion, intense conflict.
And then the third marriage, the big one, Frank Sinatra.
Ah, Sinatra. 1951 to 1957. This was perhaps her most iconic, certainly her most tumultuous relationship, profoundly impacting both their lives and careers, etching their names into Hollywood lore forever.
And she called him the love of her life.
She did. Later in her autobiography with this rare vulnerability, she stated Sinatra was the love of her life. A really powerful declaration from a woman known for her independence and, you know, reluctance to get sentimental about her past.
But their beginning was pure scandal.
A public firestorm, is putting it mildly. Sinatra, then married to his first wife, Nancy, mother of his three children, left her for Gardner. Colossal scandal. Dominated headlines worldwide.
The backlash must have been intense.
Brutal. Blasted by powerful gossip columnists like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, who held huge sway. Blasted by the conservative Hollywood establishment, the Catholic Church condemning divorce, even by his legions of adoring fans, many feeling betrayed. It nearly derailed Sinatra's career, branding him a reckless philanderer.
But Ava stood by him, even helped him professionally.
Crucially, this highlights her deep loyalty. Her formidable influence, her almost heroic support. When Sinatra's career was faltering, record sales plummeting, film roles drying up, Gardner stepped in. She used her considerable influence, particularly with Harry Cohn, the notoriously difficult, powerful head of Columbia Pictures.
Cohn was tough, getting him to do anything.
Exactly. She used her influence to get Sinatra cast in his Oscar-winning role in From Here to Eternity in 1953.
Wow. That was the comeback role.
Monumental intervention. That role and the Academy Award he won for it spectacularly revitalized both Sinatra's acting and singing careers, propelled him back to superstardom. It's a powerful, often overlooked example of her unwavering support and her sway in Hollywood. She was more than a beautiful face. She was a force, fiercely protective of those she loved.
But the marriage itself was famously rocky.
Deeply tumultuous. A whirlwind of passionate highs, destructive lows, dramatic arguments, reconciliations, infidelities on both sides. And it came with deeply personal, difficult decisions.
The pregnancies.
Yes. During their marriage, Gardner became pregnant twice, but tragically aborted both pregnancies. The reason, stated bluntly in her autobiography, is stark, revealing of the era's pressures. Quote, MGM had all sorts of penalty clauses about their stars having babies.
Chilling. Controlled even in that aspect of life.
It reveals the harsh realities, the immense pressures female stars faced under that oppressive studio system. Their bodies, their choices, their personal lives, largely controlled for profit. Gardner filed for divorce in 54, finalized in 57. But despite all the public turmoil, the personal heartbreak.
They stayed friends.
Remarkably, yes. They remained good friends for the rest of her life. Showcasing this complex, enduring bond that transcended romance, a testament to the profound connection they shared. Beyond marriages, her life was interwoven with other fascinating figures, showcasing her ability to forge deep connections that weren't always romantic or, you know, conventional.
Like Howard Hughes.
Exactly. She was a friend and protege of the enigmatic businessman and aviator Howard Hughes in the early to mid-1940s, a relationship that surprisingly lasted well into the 1950s.
But not romantic.
Not according to Ava. In her autobiography, Ava, My Story, she stated unequivocally she was never in love with Hughes. What kept their relationship alive, she said, was his trust in Gardner and her steadfast discretion qualities he rarely found. It wasn't romance. It was deeper understanding, mutual respect.
What did she think of him? He was so reclusive.
Her description offers this rare, intimate glimpse. She called him painfully shy, completely enigmatic, and more eccentric than anyone she'd ever met.
High praise for eccentricity coming from Ava Gardner.
Right. She knew colorful characters. Their bond was unusual, built on maybe a shared sense of otherness and this deep, unspoken understanding.
And there were other affairs, of course.
Of course. She lived fully, without apology, several significant affairs and relationships. The dashing Spanish matador Luis Miguel Dominguez, talk about passion and danger. The acclaimed, often volatile actor George C. Scott. And Claude Tourail, the renowned, charming restaurateur of La Tour d'Argent in Paris. Her life was clearly lived to the fullest, driven by passion, refusing to conform, always seeking vibrant company.
But she also had deep friendships. Gregory Peck.
Ah, Gregory Peck. Perhaps one of the most touching relationships, speaking to her capacity for genuine platonic love, a very close friendship that spanned the rest of her life. They first worked together in the Great Sinner in 1949, and their bond only deepened over decades, enduring through marriages, divorces, distances.
How deep was that bond?
Profoundly deep, beautifully illustrated by this touching detail. Upon our death in 1990, Peck took in both her housekeeper and her dog, extending care and compassion to those she held dear. That speaks volumes about the genuine, enduring bond they shared. A friendship transcending Hollywood's tumult, a steadfast connection in a world of fleeting relationships.
Which naturally leads us to ask, why did such a quintessential American star, one of Hollywood's leading ladies embodying American glamour, choose to live most of her later life outside the United States? It wasn't just a brief escape. It was a deliberate choice lasting decades. Suggests a deep desire for privacy, maybe, or a different lifestyle away from Hollywood's glare.
She loved Spain, didn't she?
Absolutely captivated by it. First visited in 1950, found a home there, moving in 1955, lived in Spain for over a decade until 66. A significant chapter, immersing herself in the culture, bullfighting, flamenco, a more uninhibited way of life that resonated with her independent spirit. Spain offered a vibrant escape from America's restrictive moral codes and constant scrutiny.
And then London.
Then, in 1966, another significant move, relocating to London. She lived at 34 Ennismore Gardens in Westminster, making it her final home until her death in 1990. This extended period abroad, away from the American tabloids and the demanding studio system, really indicates a clear preference for a more private, perhaps more European lifestyle. Speaks volumes about her fierce independence, her determination to shape her life on her own terms, even if it meant leaving the heart of the industry behind. She wasn't content to be just a Hollywood relic. She sought a life that let her be herself.
Her journey of faith, or maybe lack thereof, it's particularly striking too. Deeply rooted in her personal history, offering a profound insight into her character.
She was raised Baptist, right? Common in the South.
Exactly. Raised in the Baptist faith of her mother, a deeply religious woman. But by the end of her life, she stated quite plainly, no equivocation, she had no religion. This wasn't casual. It was a conviction born from a profoundly painful, defining experience from her youth.
Her father's death.
Yes. The moment that irrevocably shaped her spiritual path, vividly recounted in her autobiography and shared by her close friend Zoe Salas, happened when her father died. Ava was just 15. The local preacher, the man who'd baptized her, presided over the community's spiritual life, inexplicably refused to visit her father in his final moments.
Why would he do that?
It's unclear, but the impact on Ava was devastating. Her father was scared, alone, dying, and the man of God, in her young eyes, abandoned him. This act of perceived cruelty, indifference, left an indelible scar, fundamentally altering her worldview, her relationship with organized religion. How did she put it? She recalled it later with raw, unvarnished emotion. Nobody wanted to know Daddy when he was dying. He was so alone, he was scared. I begged him to come and visit Daddy, but he never did. He never came. God, I hated him. I had no time for religion after that. I never prayed. I never said another prayer. Not like I meant it anyway.
Wow, that's powerful. Explains so much.
It's a profound insight into her worldview, the deeply personal source of her later agnosticism. Shows how personal tragedy can fundamentally alter one's spiritual path, and how fiercely she held on to her convictions, even against her upbringing, refusing to compromise on what she felt was right, even facing spiritual authority.
This aspect of her life truly reveals a strong moral compass, a remarkable sense of social justice, especially for someone in Hollywood during that often very conservative, racially segregated era.
She was a lifelong Democrat, right?
A lifelong Democrat, aligning herself with a party often linked to progressive values. She openly supported Adlai Stevenson II in the 52 election, a choice that could sometimes invite scrutiny for a major star then. never hid her convictions.
But her stance on civil rights was particularly strong.
Staunch and consistent support for civil rights for African Americans throughout her entire life. Not a convenient stance adopted later, evident from her earliest childhood experiences. As a child in deeply segregated North Carolina, she would often sit with African American children in segregated parts of movie theaters.
Even as a kid, that's defiance.
An early, innate sense of justice, rejecting discriminatory norms. A direct act of defiance against the established social order.
And that continued into adulthood.
Forcefully. Her personal assistant, Renee Jordan, was African American, and Gardner would often take her to clubs that were for whites only, actively using her celebrity and privilege to directly confront and break down racial barriers publicly and personally. That took courage, real action, more than just rhetoric, putting herself and her career on the line. Politically, she supported Henry A. Wallace of the Progressive Party, whose 1948 campaign explicitly sought racial equality and desegregation truly radical for its time. And cementing her dedication, she officially became a member of the NAACP in August 1968.
Wow, a lifelong commitment.
These actions paint a vivid picture, a woman who didn't just advocate fairness but actively practiced it, demonstrating moral clarity and courage far ahead of her time in many respects within that often cautious, image-conscious Hollywood world.
Even Hollywood legends, for all their glamour, face the universal challenges of aging and health. Ava Gardner was no exception.
No one is immune.
In 1966, the same year she moved to London, she underwent an elective hysterectomy. Not taken lightly. A proactive, deeply personal health measure to allay her worries of contracting the uterine cancer that had claimed the life of her mother.
Understandable, given her family history. Shows a practical side.
Right. A practical approach to well-being amidst the star persona. Thoughtful consideration, taking control of her health.
And then she had a stroke later on.
Yes. In 1986, while living in London, she suffered a significant stroke. A major health challenge left her partially paralyzed, affected her speech. What's truly touching, speaking volumes about their enduring complex bond, is Frank Sinatra's response.
He stepped in.
Even though she could certainly afford her own extensive medical expenses, she had a considerable fortune. Frank Sinatra, without hesitation, insisted on paying for her visit to a specialist in the U.S., determined she get the best care.
And she let him.
Remarkably, she allowed him to make all the arrangements for a medically staffed private plane to transport her. It's a powerful testament to the lasting friendship, the profound, unconditional connection they shared long after their tumultuous marriage ended. Some bonds, it seems, truly transcend everything. Their love, though transformed, remained deeply rooted.
Her passing marked the end of an era, certainly for Hollywood's golden age, but her legacy continues to thrive, resonating decades after her death. Ava Gardner died on January 25, 1990, age 67, in Westminster, London, from bronchop pneumonia, a complication from the stroke, and a lifetime of smoking.
But she wasn't buried in Hollywood.
No. In a poignant, deeply symbolic return to her origins, not in some star-studded cemetery. Instead, testament to her enduring connection to her roots, she was laid to rest January 29 in Sunset Memorial Park in Smithfield, North Carolina.
Back near Grabtown.
Right next to her siblings and their parents, Jonas and Molly Gardner. A quiet, humble return. A full circle journey back to the very ground where her unlikely story began. Beautifully underscores the deep tie she maintained to her beginnings, despite global fame, sophisticated European life. A final, authentic statement about where she truly belonged.
She certainly left her mark on film, but she also left her own account of her life, adding another fascinating layer, offering her own voice to her legend. Her autobiography, Ava, My Story, authored during her final years, A Period of Reflection, published posthumously in 1990.
But the story behind the book itself is interesting.
Very intriguing. Reveals the pragmatism of her later years. Facing ongoing medical expenses, wanting financial security, she famously told Peter Evans, the writer she hired, to ghostwrite it.
What did she say? The Jewels quote?
I either write the book or sell the jewels. A choice born of necessity, but one that ultimately allowed her to tell her story, preserve her perspective.
But the collaboration hit a snag because of Sinatra.
Exactly. The unexpected revelation that Evan had once been sued by Frank Sinatra for comments in another book led to their friendship cooling considerably. Evans ultimately left the project before completion. Shows how intertwined her past remained, the long shadow of that love affair still influencing things.
But Evans' notes were published later.
Yes, years later. Evans' extensive notes and draft sections based on their taped conversations were posthumously published in his own book, Ava Gardner. The Secret Conversations, in 2012. offers yet another perspective, giving us this richer, multifaceted understanding, insights from her words and Evans's observations, a double portrait of a complex star.
What's truly fascinating here is how her image continues to inspire and resonate even decades after her passing. Ava Gardner's impact wasn't confined to her lifetime. It has endured, evolved in popular culture, cementing her status as a timeless icon.
The museum is a big part of that, right?
A testament to this enduring appeal is the Ava Gardner Museum, incorporated in 96, proudly located near her burial place in Smithfield, North Carolina. A permanent, living tribute, repository of costumes, photos, personal effects, memorabilia, allows fans, scholars to connect with her story intimately, honoring her memory where she considered home.
And she keeps getting portrayed in films and TV.
Her enduring appeal is vividly evident there, too. Brought to life by talented actresses like Marcia Gay Harden in the 92 miniseries Sinatra, capturing her fiery spirit. Kate Beckinsale famously portrayed her in the 2004 Howard Hughes biopic The Aviator, showing her glamour and wit. Even Debbie Mazar in the 2018 Spanish TV series Art of Madrid, a comedy drama centered on her time in Spain, shows her persona transcends borders. These portrayals speak to her iconic nature, the fascination she still holds.
And other cultural references.
Beyond biographical depictions, her image, her name keep appearing. Album covers, like Robin Gibb's 1983 album How Old Are You, featured a striking image of her. Spanish TV series, books, articles. This continuous presence, almost 35 years after her death, indicates her profound, lasting cultural impact, solidifying her place as a timeless icon whose beauty, style, independence, sheer force of personality still captivate and inspire. She remains in every sense terrific.
So what does this all mean? We've journeyed from Gravetown's tobacco fields, a world away from the spotlight, all the way to Hollywood's dazzling lights, and then later, the quiet, sophisticated streets of London. We've explored her tumultuous marriages, her fiercely independent spirit, her unwavering principles from courageous civil rights activism to her deeply personal, unshakable views on faith. Ava Gardner was so much more than just a beautiful face, more than just a siren of the silver screen. She was a woman who navigated an incredibly demanding industry while staying profoundly true to herself, even when it meant defying powerful expectations and facing intense public scrutiny. She owned her choices, for better or worse, always on her own terms.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Ava Gardner's story is a powerful reminder that authentic selfhood often comes at a significant cost, particularly under the intense scrutiny of the public eye. Her journey vividly highlights that constant tension between the carefully curated image of a star, the glamorous facade, and the complex, often challenging, fiercely independent reality of the individual living that life.
Yeah.
Her life was a masterclass in navigating that dichotomy, never fully letting the industry define her, always keeping a core of herself intact, despite the pressures and temptations of superstardom.
And think about this. From the young woman who wouldn't even eat in the MGM commissary because she was so scared to walk in and see stars like Lana Turner and Greer Garson.
Incredible to think about now.
To the seasoned actress who famously declared with absolute conviction, "I strip for nobody," when considering a role. Ava Gardner consistently battled, often defied expectations. Her life begs the question, how much of her inherent strength, her fierce independence, her unwavering unwillingness to compromise stemmed directly from those humble, challenging, often hardscrabble beginnings in rural North Carolina, rather than being solely shaped by Hollywood's glitz and demands?
That's a fascinating question. Nature versus nurture, almost.
Exactly. What parts of our own histories, those often unseen by others, those formative experiences far from the public gaze, truly define our core and empower us to live authentically on our own terms? It's definitely something to ponder.